Hello and welcome to this podcast, which deals with matters you should consider if you get a service charge bill and are unhappy with it. With me, I have Stephanie Smith, who is an experienced property barrister at Arden Chambers. Stephanie, imagine I'm a leaseholder. A service charge bill arrives on my doormat one morning. It seems on the high side. What should I do first?
I think the first port of call is essentially to consider whether the demand that has arrived on your doormat has included a summary of rights and obligations under section 21B. And if that isn't included, then you're on very strong footing to lawfully withhold your payment of service charges until that has been provided to you. If, in fact, the summary of rights and obligations has been included, then you will be informed of the method by which you can request a summary of relevant costs pursuant to section 21. That summary of relevant costs will deal with all of the expenditure incurred by the landlord in relation to your particular property and others potentially associated with your property for an accounting period of 12 months. It's only really once you receive that summary that you're in a good position to consider what costs have actually been incurred in relation to that period and whether there is a reasonable prospect of being able to challenge them. Once you have made that request, then you can inspect the relevant accounts and supporting receipts within a period of 6 months of receiving that summary, and that will enable you to obtain even more relevant information for the purposes of establishing precisely what it is you're paying for and whether you're getting good value for the money that you're paying. So once you've established what costs you're actually paying for, then it's a question of turning to the terms of your lease and whether, in fact, the costs that are being sought from you are payable pursuant to the terms of that lease. And that's dealt with in Section 27A of the 1985 Act, Landlord and Tenant Act 1985. Now, under Section 27A, the tribunal can decide whether a service charge is payable, and if so, the circumstances in which it is payable, including by whom and to whom it is payable. And an application can be made whether or not you've withheld the service charge, as to which see above, and the payment of the service charge does not amount to an admission per se, and so the question as to whether the service charge is payable remains open. Section 27A3 provides that the tribunal can determine whether a service charge would be payable in relation not only to costs which have been incurred, but in relation to anticipated costs for services, repairs, maintenance, and so on. And if so, again, the circumstances in which it is payable. So from a tenant's point of view, that means that if you are sent an estimated service charge bill, you can go through precisely the same process and make your application in the proper form, the benefit of which, obviously, is that you won't have paid the money at that point. In terms of looking to the terms of your lease, any service charge claimed must be clearly provided for in the body of the lease and must have been apparent to a reasonable tenant. When considering whether a particular cost is covered by the terms of the lease, the words must be given their natural meaning and must be viewed in context. So if having sought to construe a provision of the lease in that way, it proves impossible to establish whether it's payable or not. There's a level of ambiguity that appears within the lease. Then the principle of what's referred to by the lawyers as contra profferentum applies. And what that basically means is that where there's an ambiguity, it is interpreted in favour of the lessee in this context, the person who essentially has had the lease brought to their attention and proffered to them. There are a certain number of principles that were very clearly enunciated by Michael Rich QC in a case called Cadogan and 27 and 29 Sloan Gardens Limited, which is a 2006 upper tribunal case or lands tribunal case as it then was. And in that, there were a number of specific principles that were held to apply. It is for the landlord to show a reasonable tenant would perceive the underlease obliged him to make the payment sought, that such conclusion must emerge clearly and plainly from the words used, that if the words used could reasonably be read as providing for some other circumstance, the landlord would fail to discharge the onus upon him. It doesn't reject the natural meaning of their words in context, so you can look at the surrounding circumstances when the lease was entered into, such as, for example, promotional materials that may have been provided, which drew attention to what types of service charges would be recovered. And if consideration of the clause leaves ambiguity, then it is resolved against the landlord. In particular, when a tenant is looking at whether a particular cost is recoverable under the terms of the lease, be aware of what are referred to as sweeping up clauses. And what that means is a clause along the lines of the cost of all other services which a lessor may at its absolute discretion provide or install. Because such clauses can, albeit they don't specifically refer to listed items of expenditure, may catch other forms that would otherwise fall outside the terms of the lease. So be very careful to establish whether such a clause exists within the body of the lease before firing off an application to the court or tribunal. Section 19 of the 1985 Act concerns whether costs are reasonably incurred and whether the services or works are of a reasonable standard. And it's important not to conflate those two limbs with a general assessment of reasonableness, which it seems to me some tribunal decisions have fallen into the trap of so doing. In real terms, what this test means is that where relevant costs are incurred, one has to establish whether they fall within what is the reasonable spectrum of being incurred. So it isn't a question of saying, I think that you incurring these costs, Mr. Landlord, is something that I wouldn't have done. It is whether it is beyond a range of particular reasonable steps that the landlord may have taken in the particular circumstances. And there are a number of authorities that support that contention, including cases of Forslops and Sweetman, and also Regent Management and Jones, which is a 2010 tribunal decision, and most recently the case of Southall Court and Tiwari, which is a 2011 tribunal decision. So in order to show a cost is reasonably incurred, a leaseholder has to show that the decision to incur the cost was one which no reasonable landlord could possibly have reached, or that it was perverse for the landlord to incur those costs. In terms of reasonable standard, essentially, it's a question of fact for the tribunal. What I would say is that any tenant seeking to raise issues in relation to standards of services being carried out or works being carried out will need to provide pretty cogent evidence of the fact that the standard falls below that which would ordinarily reasonably be expected in the circumstances of the price which is being paid for it.
Right. Thanks very much, Stephanie. I've been going through this bill and I notice some of the things I'm being charged for seem pretty old, from several years ago. Should that concern me?
I think it absolutely should concern you. By Section 20B of the 1985 Act, if any relevant cost is incurred more than 18 months before a demand for payment of the service charge has been served on the tenant, then the tenant isn't liable to pay it. And so consequently, if you receive a demand in relation to costs that were incurred, in relation to which essentially payment was made or invoices received more than 18 months ago, then you are not liable for those costs. That is subject to a proviso. If the tenant is notified in writing within that 18-month period, beginning when the costs were in fact incurred, then he... that he would be required essentially to pay them under the terms of the lease or to contribute to them by payment of the service charge, then the tenant is liable to pay them. So it's not merely a question of when you receive the demand, it's whether you've been notified that the liability will accrue essentially within the 18-month period before the demand is made. There are a number of cases which deal with the applicability of Section 20B to interim and subsequent balancing service charges. And in particular, in the case of Gilger and Charlgrove, which is a 2003 High Court decision, Mr. Justice Etherton, as he then was, held that Section 20B didn't apply where payments on account were made in respect of service charges, where the landlord's actual expenditure did not exceed the payment on account, and where no request by the landlord for any further payment by the tenant needed to be or was in fact made. And his ratio or justification for that decision was that the purpose of Section 20B was to avoid the tenant being faced with a bill in respect of which he'd had insufficient warning. And so it wasn't intended to prevent the landlord. It wasn't a punitive measure, essentially. If you don't give the demand in good time, then you're not able to recover it. It's whether there's in fact been proper notice. And finally, in relation to that particular issue, a tenant should bear in mind that in the decision in OM and Burr, which is a 2012 tribunal decision, when a cost is incurred is a question of fact for the tribunal to decide, but it's based on one of two alternatives, either when the invoice has been presented or when subsequent payment is made. It certainly strikes me that that decision isn't necessarily consistent with normal accounting practices, but certainly that is what we are to deal with at the moment, and tenants should operate on the basis, certainly in my view, that once the date that they should essentially take is the sort of most favourable to the landlord, so when the payment is in fact made, which is most likely to be the later date, should really be when they seek to challenge under pursuant to Section 20B.
Right. About some of the items on the bill, should I have been consulted about them beforehand?
Well, that depends. Not all charges that are incurred are subject to a requirement for consultation. What essentially a tenant is looking to establish is whether a particular contract that is entered into constitutes a qualifying long-term agreement or a QLTA, and whether or not works which are carried out fulfil the threshold in terms of the amount that is payable for consultation to apply. I think an important thing for leaseholders to understand is that whilst lawyers speak of consultation requirements, Section 20 doesn't prevent a landlord from entering into a contract of any description. What it prevents is him recovering necessarily all of the costs of entering into that contract. So the LVT is not in a position to make an order, or county court's not in a position to make an order, to prevent a landlord from using a particular contractor or to specify the types of works that can or cannot be carried out. It is essentially about the amount of money that the landlord can recover for carrying out those works. Now, qualifying works, to start, are defined as works on a building or other premises where the contribution of any tenant will exceed £250 in any accounting period. That doesn't mean that every tenant has to have £250 worth of works. It means that any one tenant, of any number of tenants in a particular block, incurs that liability. Works on a building comprise matters that are normally to be regarded as building works, so they don't include, for example, the cleaning of windows. It's important to distinguish what is a qualifying work and what isn't. In relation to qualifying long-term agreements, with the limited exceptions for which see Regulation 3 of the 2003 regs, any agreement entered into by or on behalf of a landlord for a term of more than 12 months and where the contribution of any tenant will be more than £100 in any accounting period would constitute a qualifying long-term agreement. Now, there was a decision in the Upper Tribunal in Paddington Walk and Governors of Peabody Trust Central where it was held that a management agreement for an initial term of 12 months and thereafter periodically for 12 months, but subject to 3 months' notice, was not a QLTA. Although the contract was capable of continuing for more than 12 months, the original period did not exceed 12 months. It was merely for 12 months, and consequently it wasn't a QLTA and consultation requirements didn't apply. Now, in a practical sense, albeit that consultation requirements can be split into five different types, ones where public notice is required, ones where public notice isn't required, and relating to both qualifying long-term agreements and qualifying works. In practice, what a lessee is most likely to come across are qualifying works where public notice isn't required. This is what I would say is the most common situation, and in terms of summarising the process, essentially it's a three-stage process concerning the service of a notice of intention, followed by a 30-day period, followed by a collection of estimates by the landlord, and then a second notice and a paragraph B statement is served, and then a further relevant period of 30 days And then finally, when the contract is entered into, there is another notice requirement which follows. The notice of intention has to be given to each tenant and an RTA if one is in existence, and the notice has to set out certain prescribed requirements. I won't go through them in detail because we could be here for hours talking about consultation requirements, but certainly the substantive procedure is not contained within the statute itself, but is in fact contained within the Service Charges Consultation Requirements, England Regs 2003, which is SI 2003-1983, and which can be obtained, as I understand it, on the lease website, but also if one consults Bailey, for example, which is a legal statutory search engine, you'll be able to find out what they are. The relevant period is a period of 30 days, beginning with the date that any notice is served. And in terms of the relevant period, be careful when the notice was actually served on you as a tenant, because if it doesn't give you the 30-day period because it's delivered late or whatever, then technically there is a defect in terms of the consultation process. The date for the purposes of the start of the relevant period is in fact the date that it would have been received in the ordinary course of post. So it's actually 2 days after it was committed to post, rather than the date that appears on the letter or on the notice itself. I'll move on to what is a really hot topic for the purposes of this podcast, which is the question of dispensation, because just because a landlord hasn't complied with the full technical prescriptions relating to consultation doesn't mean that they won't necessarily be allowed to recover all of the sums expended in the qualifying works or qualifying long-term agreement. And that's because the LVT has a power to dispense with the requirement for consultation in appropriate circumstances, and that's found in Section 20ZA of the 1985 Act. Now, the LVT has been able to give dispensation since October of 2003 in England, and in Wales since 2004. It is somewhat surprising, in my view, that it is only yesterday, which is March the 6th of 2013, some 10 years afterwards, that the Supreme Court has finally considered what the correct approach to dispensation ought to be, and it has flown in the face of what has gone before. The Supreme Court yesterday considered the decision in Dejan Investments Limited and Benson and others, it is really required reading in relation to the question of dispensation. Now, in Dejan, the freeholder owned a building in London. It contained 7 flats, 5 of which were let on long leases to the respondents. And the leases provided in the usual way for Dejan to be responsible for repair of the building and for leaseholders to contribute to service charges. Now, they failed to comply strictly with the consultation requirements. They failed to provide a summary of observations. They failed to make estimates available for inspection, and they didn't allow 30 days for observations to be made. And the LVT at first instance found that substantial prejudice had been caused to the lessees, and it rejected an argument that it was for them to demonstrate what they had lost. Essentially, it said that the breach was so serious that effectively the lessees weren't required to demonstrate prejudice. It rejected an offer from Dejan in that case that it wouldn't pass on the entire costs of the qualifying works in that case. Effectively what it said that the argument that the financial effects of granting or refusing dispensation on the landlord and tenant were relevant was not the case, that essentially one looked at the prejudice, and that's one where one started. The Upper Tribunal rejected Dejan's appeal, finding it wasn't for leaseholders to prove any specific prejudice, and that if the breach were serious, that dispensation essentially ought to be refused. Dejan again appealed to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal again rejected that argument. The Court of Appeal held that the starting point was the decision of the LVT. It was the LVT that had to be entrusted by statute with deciding the issue of dispensation, and so the Upper Tribunal's subsequent decision wasn't really the point to start from, albeit one could take into account the views that were expressed by that tribunal. But what it said in relation to the substantive issue on appeal was that the draconian financial consequences of a failure to grant dispensation was not a relevant factor. Secondly, it found the nature of the landlord might be a relevant factor, but that wasn't present on the facts of the case, because Dejan was a large company, a large organisation, and so the fact that it wasn't comprised of, for example, leaseholders in the same way an RTM company might be, was not relevant. And thirdly, it found that the degree of prejudice caused for tenants was of primary significance in any dispensation application, and because there had been what was considered to be a serious failing by Dejan, the loss of the opportunity to enjoy a full consultation process was itself significant prejudice. The Supreme Court upheld Dejan's appeal from that decision. Insofar as is relevant for these purposes, they approached the issue as follows. The 85 Act required a landlord to consult his tenant before carrying out qualifying works to ensure the tenant was protected from paying for works that are unnecessary or of defective standard, or for paying more for works than is necessary. It wasn't a punitive measure and shouldn't be construed as such. The seriousness of the breach of the regulations was not, in fact, a relevant factor. The sole issue was the extent to which the leaseholders had suffered prejudice as a result of any failing. As a result of that, consequently, the financial implications were accordingly irrelevant, and the type of landlord was irrelevant. The LVT had a power to grant dispensations on such terms as it thought fit, provided that those terms were appropriate in their nature and effect. And what that essentially permitted was that if the failure to consult resulted in increased costs, then that could be a condition of dispensation being granted, that those costs would not be passed on to the lessees. And also, another condition of the grant of dispensation was that the landlord would pay the leaseholders reasonable costs incurred in resisting the application for dispensation.
Right. So you've told me what my rights are. I've tried to do a deal with the landlord, the managing agents, but haven't made any headway. And I'm thinking about going further. And what rights have I got available? What avenues or forums can I go to challenge the bill?
Well, if litigation is essentially the last possible option available to you, then there are two fora that you can approach to determine your dispute with your landlord. The first is the county court, and the second is the leasehold valuation tribunal, which is soon to become the property chamber as of the what we've now been told is the 1st of July of 2013. Now, there are a number of reasons why a case may start in the county court, not least of which is a claim brought by the landlord for a debt in relation to service charges, and often that is done as a precursor to commencing forfeiture proceedings. If there is a valid challenge to the reasonableness of service charges in such a context, then the county court is where you will most likely find yourself. There is an increasing tendency for the court to transfer anything remotely service charge related to the leasehold valuation tribunal in any event. So just because you start your case in the county court doesn't mean you're going to stay there during the whole course of the proceedings and not have the benefit, in inverted commas, of having the leasehold valuation tribunal's expertise on the issue, because there is a power for the county court to transfer. Now, matters that the county court will bear in mind in relation to any transfer include the specialist nature of the LVT. The LVT is comprised of a tribunal which includes surveyors, lawyers and the like. And they are, it seems to me, in the best position to determine non-legally complex issues relating to service charge disputes. It seems to me that complex questions of law are often best left in the remit of the county court. And so it may be if there are substantive disputes in relation to, for example, limitation periods or how you are going to get your money back once you've had a determination in your favour, that it may be more appropriate to leave that within the forum of the county court. A lessee should be aware of the fact that if there is a transfer, then that will inevitably result in a level of delay. And also the concomitant additional costs being incurred in the form of having to go to yet another court hearing to have directions set down for a hearing of the service charge dispute. It seems to me, preferable to resolve multiple issues in one forum, and the LVT, unfortunately, is in a position where it has no real enforcement powers. And it may be that when one looks at a case that involves complex issues of law with a dispute relating to service charges, where ultimately it may result in a claim for restitution, for example, that that type of case may benefit from staying in the county court. Nonetheless, the county court and the LVT do have the same powers in relation to restricting cost recovery, and so that shouldn't form a reason. It's a common misapprehension that the LVT is the cheaper place to go to. That isn't necessarily the case, because the county court has a dual jurisdiction in relation to Section 20C orders. The alternative forum for your service charge dispute, and the place that most often lessees are advised to bring their applications to dispute service charges, is the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal. It is designed to be an informal tribunal, but nonetheless, lessees should not mistake that informality for a complete lack of judicial procedure, because there is judicial procedure that must be followed. And it has to be observed irrespective of whether you are counsel QC or whether you are a layperson. But the way in which a standard case in the LVT pans out is as follows. The application is made in one of the prescribed forms that one can obtain from the website. More often than not, a pretrial review is listed within sort of 6 weeks to a couple of months of the application being made. And at that point, a timetable is set down for a hearing of the matter. And ordinarily, mediation is recommended at that point as well, which I'll come on to in a second. That timetable has to include any potential amendments to the application. It may be that when you issued your application, you were contacted by the landlord and they informed you of various matters that settled some parts of your claim and raised more questions in relation to other parts. And so ordinarily one would expect to see permission for amendments to the application to be made. That'll be followed by further statements of case. For example, the landlord will want to respond to your application most probably. Followed by service of witness statements, the provision of any expert evidence if it's required, disclosure of all of the accounts and files that are held by the landlord, preparation of hearing bundles, and then a date and time for the adjourned hearing. The hearing ordinarily comprises an inspection, normally in the morning, followed by the parties then introducing their cases and evidence and submission following on from that. And then finally, the LVT ordinarily will do a decision in writing, and that will normally follow within a few weeks of the hearing being made. So don't go to the hearing expecting that you're going to come away with a decision, because in all likelihood you aren't. The general rule is that you're not going to be able to obtain legal aid in relation to appearing before the tribunal. It's only in very exceptional circumstances that type of funding is available. And also be aware that there is no precedent in the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal. So one LVT decision doesn't bind another LVT in terms of decision making. From July the 1st this year, 2013, the Property Chamber is due to be launched, which effectively will be a consolidating tribunal, taking into account the Residential Property Tribunal Service, the Agricultural Land Tribunals, and the Adjudicator to Her Majesty's Land Registry. The current procedural rules will effectively be morphed and consolidated with procedural rules that relate to those other tribunals, and they'll come into force again from the 1st of July of 2013. In particular, in relation to those rules, one has to be aware of the fact that the cost rules are going to be significantly amended. Now, the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal originally was intended to be a no-cost forum, subject to a £500 penalty award, essentially, for frivolous, vexatious or abusive cases or conduct by the parties. But what that didn't prevent, albeit it was intended to be a no-cost forum, was the common law right of freeholders, subject to the terms of their lease, to recover service legal costs via the service charge. If the lease says they can, and they do. Since 1997, the landlord who tries to obtain or has the ability to obtain legal costs via the service charge can have that ability curtailed by the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal pursuant to Section 20C of the 85 Act, if it considers it just and equitable to do so. So what that prevents is any cost that the landlord incurs cannot just be fed through the service charge to be paid by all of the leaseholders, unless the LVT thinks it's right to do so. And ordinarily one would expect to see the landlord be entirely victorious in any application for those sorts of orders to be made. The LVT also has a power to order reimbursement of a particular party's fees. But the new rules will introduce essentially what is a costs forum in the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal. and costs orders will be made to sanction non-compliance with the orders of the tribunal, the chamber as it then will be, and if a person has acted unreasonably in bringing, defending or conducting proceedings. So this is one step removed from the no-cost forum originally intended. It seems to me that the practical outcome is unlikely to be that significant costs awards will be made, because it almost mirrors the small claims track costs that operate in the under the civil procedure rules in the county court. And ordinarily one wouldn't expect significant costs awards to be made within that track. The other thing that leaseholders should certainly bear in mind in light of a number of decisions over the course of the last 4 or 5 years is that landlords are able to recover in appropriate circumstances their legal costs as an administration charge. And a leaseholder who is charged his legal costs via a variable administration charge has significantly fewer rights than if they went through as a service charge. The principal one of which is that there's no provision equivalent to Section 20C to prevent a landlord from recovering those costs via an administration charge. It seems to me that that cannot be what Parliament intended, and in my view it seems likely that that's going to be dealt with at some point or another.
Right. Thanks very much, Stephanie. Do you have any final thoughts?
I think that one of the key things that I seek to impress upon lessees that come to me is do not waste the opportunity of mediating effectively with the other side. And there are two reasons why I say this. The first is that the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal is constrained in terms of the relief it is able to provide you. Essentially, it will provide you with a determination that will either result in you not having to pay such high service charges in the future, or which will reimburse you ultimately from the service charge account if restitution is something that you seek. So if you are actually looking for a reimbursement of service charges already paid. But what that doesn't deal with is the frustration that often accompanies a dispute with your landlord. It doesn't provide you with the power to view and see documentation that the landlord isn't happy for you to see, because there's no power within the Leasehold Valuation Tribunal to order that to take place. And ultimately, if you have real issues with the way in which your block is being managed, short of applying in separate proceedings for the appointment of a manager or exercising the right to manage, it can't address those issues either. And often these are matters that are more important than the money to lessees. So mediation isn't a rights-based resolution. It isn't about a lessee being right or wrong or a landlord being right or wrong. It's about taking the interests and the needs of those parties and discovering how they can be best reconciled. It's not a quick and cheap process if it's done properly, but it will save you the cost of having to proceed to trial and potentially lose and now, in current circumstances, be landed with either a very high service charge or administration charge bill. If mediation simply isn't effective, then, and there are persistent problems with overcharging or poor service provision, which LVT determinations in relation to service charges haven't rectified, then avoid jumping to try and exercise the right to manage and try applying to the LVT for the appointment of a manager as the first port of call, because the right to manage is a pretty onerous obligation and isn't necessarily entered into with a full understanding of the implications for individual lessees.
Right, thanks very much. And thanks very much, Stephanie, for enlightening us as to what to do when a service charge bill arrives. And thanks very much, listeners, for listening into this podcast.